All right, Jenny, we're ready for you.
Okay. My name is Jenny Hightower. I am 51 years old. Today is Wednesday, November 25th, 2020. I am in Viola, Idaho, and I am talking today with my mom, Mary Jasper. Good morning. My name is Mary Jasper. I'm 79 years old. The date is November 25th, 2020. I'm calling from Phoenix, Arizona, and I'm talking with my daughter, Jenny Hightower. So, Mom, I know the last number of years you've been collecting a lot of family stories and writing them down and collecting pictures because you are the oldest living member of our family, and you have discovered that there are seven generations of Coloradoans in our family, people who still live there, and they've been living there for seven generations. Do you know the story of how our family first went to Colorado?
Yes, I do, Jenny. It's very interesting, and I think that the Civil War was very important. My great-grandfather, Tinker, on my mother's side, had been a soldier in the last two battles of the Civil War that had been just totally devastating. And then my great-grandmother, on my father's side, who was the first person on that side of the family to come to Colorado, she also was listed as a soldier and a nurse in the Civil War at the age of 14 and 16. And it was such a devastating, 500,000 people were killed in the Civil War. It was the bloodiest, worst war that America has ever been in. And when my grandfather Tinker went back to Sag Harbor, which was the harbor for New York City after the war, been fighting and such horrible horrors. And when he got there, everything was in disarray. He was not just picking up where he had left when he gone to the war. Things were so different. He wasn't married at that time. And so then my great-grandmother McNary had lived in Kentucky. And she is listed as a soldier in the Civil War at the age of 14, and that she had been either arrested or had been in a lot of trouble because of the 15th Amendment. For some reason, she did not go with the 15th Amendment, which is no slavery in America. I don't know what happened. But for both of them, it has been a devastating time. Mm-hmm. And my grandmother then got married to a doctor, a medical doctor, after the war. Mm-hmm. And in the early part of the 20th century, in 1907, her husband had died. She was a widow, and her son, her youngest son, my grandfather, who is Frank, decided that they would go to Colorado and homestead. And so
So Deborah McNary is your great grandmother.
Yes, and she's the first person in the family line that went to Colorado. Yes.
Oh. And she took one of her sons, or her sons took her. Her son
yeah.
took her to Colorado.
Yes, and they went together. She was a widow, And she'd never seen mountains before, not mountains like the Rocky Mountains. And at that time, Colorado was blooming in the late half of the 19th century. There were gold busts, and there was also ranching, and the train made it so you could go to Colorado, on train from Cheyenne into Denver. So it was totally wide open, and being such a terrible place in Civil War, the Colorado must have just seemed like heaven.
Must have been like the promised land.
Yeah, I think for many, many of the soldiers in the Civil War, that's true. So my grandfather, Frank Hurst's son, had filed in Homestead Act in, I believe it was like 1909, and he then, in the March of 1909, had gone and had gone with her, and they had rented a house in Denver for her to stay in while he got a building or some place to live, and he went then to the ranch. It's probably 125, 130 miles, Denver, to Sugar City, which was the name of the closest town. And she stayed in Denver while he went and got things done.
Do you know how they got from Kentucky to Denver?
I believe they went by train. I have some letters that Deborah had written to her sisters, and she said that Frank had friends and family who were going by covered wagon. And when they went by covered wagon, then they had livestock and they were bringing farm implements with them. But they didn't have any livestock and they didn't have any farm implements, so I believe that they traveled by train. So
then he must have bought materials or something in Denver and then took them down to the homestead around Sugar City?
Yes. Well, she in her letter she states that he had ordered and they had sent beams for the roof and for the for framing the house, and that they were planning on doing sod, making sod, after they had the house up. The Homestead Act said that you had to live on your property, and you would be able to get 160 acres as a homesteader, and so that's what he was doing while she was living in a boarding house in Denver, the lumber was sent for the house, but when he tried to make sod for the walls, it only crumbled. They didn't realize how dry and semi-arid the land had been. So eventually they bought wood and made it a regular house. So
made a little cabin. Do you
yeah.
know what they were planning to do there? Were they planning to farm or ranch, or was she going to be a nurse, or what? Do you know what their plan was?
Well, they came from Kentucky and Missouri, and they're definitely farmland, and it's very green and humid, and it's nothing like eastern Colorado,
semi-arid.
Like so, I don't know. She had said in one of her letters that it had rained, and then one night, all night long, and snowed in the mountains, but she hadn't seen any more moisture for another 4 months. and they just had not realized how semi-arid it was, and that they had heard that in Oklahoma and Kansas and other places that it homesteaded, as soon as people get there and they start cultivating, then the weather changes, that there would be more moisture and more rain. But they had to carry water for a mile and a half when they got there, until my grandfather had been able to dig a well. So,
wow.
Yeah. So
they found themselves in a high desert instead of in a lush farmland.
Yeah,
so
and I think they really didn't realize that. Well, they there was Sugar City in 1890. There were a lot of investors came, and they decided that they would start a sugar beet factory, and they would. And it was a boom town, even until like 1930, 1940, maybe 20 or 30,000 people lived in it, and this was only seven, 8 miles from my family's property, their homestead, and. The Arkansas River came from Colorado, and so that's where it takes a lot of water to grow sugar beets and to have a sugar refinery. And at first, it probably would have been okay, but then the Denver Aurora is a section of Denver and Colorado Springs and Pueblo. They were towns in the watershed before eastern Colorado, and they got the water rights for most of the Arkansas River. So by the time that 1910 or 11 or so came by, when they had their homesteads built and ready to go, there was really no water for farming. And so they got sheep and grew sheep, and that's what they did. My grandfather was became the county commissioner, and part of his job was for education. He would go throughout the area and see where schools needed to be built, and then find people. Teach school teachers, and anyway, he was that. That's what he did. My grandmother, so my great grandmother then was still living with him, and then in the interim, there were two sisters that weren't married, and they came from Ohio, and they each had filed for a homestead, which was 160 each. You had to live on your homestead, so they built one building, and the border of the homesteads went right through the center of the building. And
they were
so
both living on their own homestead, but in the same building.
They homesteaded totally by themselves. You know, there was no family. They didn't know anybody. So anyway,
what was
and
there?
I think.
What was their names? The
oh, sisters. Alice and Jenny Frazier.
Alice and Jenny Frazier.
Mm-hmm. And I think the Civil War also has in some ways changed their lives a little bit, because they were marriable age, but with 500,000 soldiers killed, I'm thinking that perhaps there were fewer men around, so they just decided that they would go to Colorado on homestead. Well, in the meantime, then Frank and my grandmother Alice, they were they homesteaded next door, and Frank was in charge of schools. My grandmother and Jenny and my aunt Jenny had been both teachers in Ohio. And they built a one-room schoolhouse right in the vicinity of where they were homesteading. And the two sisters became the one-room schoolhouse teachers.
and Frank was the boss?
Yeah, and then my grandparents, Frank and Alice, got married. So
okay. That's how it started happening.
So then I don't know, about a year later, my father was born. And it was at Christmas time, and it was very, in her letter, she mentions how cold it is in the house. And of course, they had no telephone, no electricity, no running water. I mean, it was incredibly, in our day and age, it would be impossible. but that's where the, and he was, my father was premature. Uh-huh. And there were no doctors around, but my great-grandmother, Deborah, had learned to be a nurse, and she had later then married a medical doctor. And so she was a good nurse. And when her grandson was born, and he was having a terrible, he was dying, my grandmother did not have enough milk for her baby out mm-hmm. on the Eastern semi-deserts of Colorado. So my great-grandmother, I'm sure, nursed him as much as she could. And they found an ad, a mail order ad, for a formula to feed babies. And they sent away for that. And I think it was called Tablum, or it's like... anyway, it was a milk
a
type of thing.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, baby. And it got to the ranch, and they gave it to my father, and he started immediately to get better.
Uh-huh.
So there were, by that time, they had lived at the ranch, I don't know, 3-4 years, I don't know, maybe even longer than that.
Uh-huh.
And all the neighbors were close, you know, they were doing the same thing, but there were no telephones. No, you'd have to go talk to people. So if all of the neighbors and a few families that were in the area that were homesteading too, every morning they would get up and take their telescopes and look and see if there was a diaper hanging by Alice's house. If there was, then it meant that Sam was still alive. So, anyway,
so
their
form of communication wasn't through phone, and it was through hanging diapers, right?
Yeah, and how
they
she got
celebrate.
It was through mail order, and they had to go 7 miles into Sugar City to get pick up their mail, and she, I mean, miracle. I mean, these people were creative and tough. So
yeah, there's no Amazon coming to deliver anything in 1910, huh?
Basically no roads. There were wagon roads, but yeah. You know, county line road. I mean, yeah.
That's a great story. It must have seemed to us, it seems like that would be so isolating and lonely, but it must have seemed like they had friends and family around because they had...
Well, they had a school, and the
yeah.
school had all the children, and so what happened was they made the school into a church,
mm-hmm.
and my great-grandmother... Deborah's father was a doctor of divinity in Kentucky, and he was a Presbyterian minister,
uh-huh.
and he had taught Deborah Greek because so much of the Bible is written in Greek, and so she She knew everything about Greek and living in eastern Colorado in the early 1900s. It's an amazing story. And so she was a Sunday school in this little one-room schoolhouse. And one of the letters says that the pastor from the church in Sugar City, there was a evangelist, like a tent evangelist, who was traveling around the United States. And he came to Sugar City, and the Sugar City pastor brought him to their little schoolhouse church.
Uh-huh.
And brought people to from Sugar City, and there were a lot of young people, it says, and there was one family that wanted to be Christians, but they didn't know how, and she led them to the Lord. And so they had lots of difficulties, but they also were believers.
Well, it sounds like there's quite a community there that supported each other and influenced each other, and they needed each other.
That's right. That's right. And the positiveness of having spiritual direction, and she grew up in a family like that. So my other side, my tinker's other side, my mother's side,
uh-huh.
They came over on the Mayflower,
mm-hmm.
and then my great-grandfather had been in the Civil War, and he and his wife had three children when they started out from New York Harbor across land, and they had one child born on the way, and then two after they had gotten to north central Colorado. It was in the mountains in Fort Collins.
Uh-huh.
And the census says that they were relocating for 3 years. This family took 3 years to go across the nation from New York Harbor to Colorado.
That's a long moving day.
It is. Unbelievable. Anyway, there's lots of stories that go with this, but the story that I would really like to tell is that my mother's side of the family, my mother had one brother, and he had been killed when he was just going to start college, and in a terrible accident. And it had been so tremendous, sad for his mother, who is my grandmother, it is his death, that she was in shock for several years. She just like was in comatose. And things happened, and they had to move, and my grandfather did the whole thing, while my grandmother, he would get her up and dress her and feed her in the morning, and then he would have to have a job. And anyway, it was such a traumatic thing. They went to Colorado Springs, and then my mother, who was just a year younger than than Sam, my person who became my father, they were both in high school.
Mm-hmm.
And my mother had been totally uprooted from because they had moved from Fort Collins.
Right, and her mom hadn't been present because her mom was traumatized from her son's death, yeah.
And so my mother was in high school, and it was just, so my grandfather found a small Presbyterian church in Colorado Springs because the large Presbyterian church didn't have any teenage or any place that he could take my mother to maybe find friends. So my Tinker grandfather took my mother to this group for teenagers at this little church, and my father happened to be there. Well, a couple of days later, it was the custom then, if you wanted to date a girl, then you would go to the girl's family and meet her father and mother and introduce yourself so they would know who their daughter was dating. So my father did that. And he went to their house, he knocked on the door. My grandfather answered, and my father said, I'm Sam McNary, and I would like to meet you. So, of course, he was asked in. And as my father talked and said a little bit, you know, introduced himself, my grandmother woke up, and she was totally normal. It was his voice, the fact that there was hope. I don't know. It was just an absolute, it was a godsend.
So Grandpa's voice kind of sparked something in his future mother-in-law that made her realize that she could be present again.
Yeah, and that there was, I don't know what it was. No, none of us know exactly what it was, mm-hmm. but they had problems homesteading. I mean, huge problems. And but there were magical times also that they were brought together. And I think that was really what spurred them on. In this little church where my great grandmother Deborah and my grandfather McNary Frank, they have been an integral part of this little Westminster Presbyterian church that my father had met my mother at. And when my grandfather Saint Frank died, it was just a tiny church. I don't know, probably held 50 people. But when he died, there were so many people that came to the funeral that there was a block on each side of this tiny little church that people were standing on the sidewalk so that they could be part of his funeral.
How did they leave the ranch? Because they're not there anymore. So how did they leave the ranch and where did they go?
They went to Colorado Springs.
Mm-hmm.
And so both my Tinker grandparents had gone to Colorado Springs, and then my McNary, they had gone to Colorado Springs, and so my parents met each other, and one of the reasons they had gone to Colorado Springs was because it was a very long drought, and they needed money, so they drove their sheep to the nearest railroad station and sold their sheep.
Alice and Frank and
yes.
Grandpa. Uh-huh.
Yes. And the sheep, they'd had the sheep for like a year or, you know, for growing season. And it was like 10 cents a pound less that they could sell them for at the railroad. And they had no more money.
It was a big loss.
So it had been a terrible drought.
Mm-hmm.
In the letters, my great-grandmother had said that there were people who had brought plows to farm, and some of these people would come and plow your land so that when it did rain or snow, the moisture would sink into your ground.
Mm-hmm.
Well, 1925 is when they left, and I think so many people in the Homestead Act had been from places that there was farms and there was a lot of water and rain and moisture, and when they came and they wanted to farm, they did they dug up the topsoil, and it didn't change the weather. And so, and my grandparents left in the ranch in 1925. In 1936 is the Dust Bowl. Mm-hmm. And that is when Eastern Colorado, Oklahoma, New Mexico, Texas, all just, it was an unreal long drought.
Yeah.
And it was a very serious thing, but they were already gone.
What did they do when they went to Colorado Springs?
There had been gold mines in the mountains near Colorado Springs, and they had built a railroad from Colorado Springs up to Cripple Creek, where the biggest mines were, and they brought all the ore back down to Colorado Springs to a gold refinery there.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where my grandfather found a job, and he worked there, and they bought a house, and my father was fourth or fifth grade. He was like 10, 11, and he had never worn shoes. He hated the city. But my great-grandmother, who knew Greek and who was very educated, and her father was a doctor of divinity, and her husband had been a medical doctor.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, she had spent my father's preschool years teaching him to read and write, and that was her job at that time. And so then after he got old enough to go to a school that his mother and his aunt taught, then my great-grandmother didn't have to take care of him. And what she did then was if anyone in the whole homestead area, if anyone was in any family anywhere was sick, and she then, if they would contact her and tell her, she had a wagon, she'd get in her wagon and go to the person's house where they were so sick, and she would nurse them back to be well, or if they died, then she would prepare their bodies and bury them.
You have 7 minutes left.
That's like the true meaning of a nurse, huh? Somebody
yes.
really cares
and,
for them.
And I think that that's what kept them all going. I mean, there was so many things that that they had no control over, but they really were believers.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's yeah. Then in
they were there for a purpose, huh?
Yeah. Then in 1938, or 39, my father, who was in Colorado Springs, who had gone to trade school and had a good job and two children, he and his best friend went back to the ranch and were starting to build up their livestock. And it was going great. His friend was on the ranch, and my father was payrolling the project. And then the Second World War came, and his friend was drafted into the Second World War. So my father never got to move back to the ranch, but he had hoped that would happen. But what can you do if a war comes along?
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, I don't.
Well, I'm wondering, I'm thinking about how different, you know, how different 100, 110 years is, you know. We have got Deborah and Frank taking the train west. We've got Ginny and your grandma Alice coming out in a wagon to be teachers, and two ladies who build their own house and live on it, you know, without... Well, and teach the children in the area, and then what it must have been like to move to the city, and in that time frame, cars are coming into the scene, and then they move to the city.
Yeah.
That must have been just totally two total ends of the spectrum that they lived their lives in.
Yeah, my father hated it at first because he was, I don't know, 11 or 12, and all the kids made fun of him because he had homemade clothes, and he'd never worn shoes, and he had to wear shoes, and he hated it. But he could read, and he was an excellent student because he had had his grandmother teach him.
He wasn't just a quaint homesteader. He actually had some skills that he could take. And
yes,
he was in the city, too. Just not wearing shoes wasn't one of them.
Yeah, he was probably the best student in the class. But he had a gun, and there were a lot of rattlesnakes. He killed rattlesnakes. He had a dog that he and the dog, he kept the dog with him all the time to keep him safe while he was out. So, and he also, they had a car. We could to go to town, and my grandfather, being the county commissioner, had to travel around. My father, at the age of 10 or so, learned how to drive, and he would drive my grandmother into town, which is Sugar City, which is 7 miles away, if she had to go shopping, which I don't think she hardly ever did go shopping, but he was her chauffeur because my grandmother never learned how to drive. So it was absolute as far as freedoms and doing things. It was very difficult for my father to change that, yeah.
So Grandma Alice never learned to drive, but she did end up living in Denver, right?
Yes, Yeah, at the end of the Second World War and afterwards, she lived in Denver, and she and her sister had lived together all their lives. And when her sister died, when they lived in Denver, then my grandmother needed something to think about, and she became an expert. She knew everything about Shakespeare. Whenever anybody went to visit her or she would tell us all about what she was learning about the next Shakespeare play.
You have 5 minutes left.
And she had never gone to a live Shakespeare play, but she learned, and then later on opera, and she did that through the radio and books.
And what did she think of you in the 1960s?
Well, your father and I were living in Denver, and it was our first year of marriage, and it was Christmas time, and I went to pick her up, and then we were going to go get your father at work, and we were going to Colorado Springs to spend Christmas, and the traffic, it was just before Christmas, and the traffic was terrible in Denver in 1980. Now 1960, and there were two freeways at that time, and I had to change from one to the other, and I heard her, she smacked her lips, go, when she got nervous, and I looked over and I said, Grandma, what's wrong? And she said, oh, how can you do this, Mary? This is so hard and difficult. I could never do this with all these cars and all these roads and everybody's so impatient. And I looked at her, and I was only 19. My baby was in the back seat. And I said, Grandma, you homesteaded with Aunt Jenny by yourselves. What you did was so much more difficult and brave and took so much more courage and we both looked at each other and we thought, wow, the Lord put you where you are.
It's all about perspective, right?
Yes, it is. It is about perspective.
So we're just hitting 40 minutes, so it's time to wrap things up.
Well, Mom, those being seven generations of Colorado residents, and that's just amazing. And I love to hear, you know, Colorado's such an important part of our family, where we spend all our vacations and have so much family and loved ones there and friends and so much history and places that our family claims and loves to spend time. And I love hearing how it all started, and that's wonderful, Mom. Thank you.
And right now we have four children. Two of them were born in Colorado, and our oldest daughter had eight children who lived in Colorado since she was in high school, and her eight children live in Colorado, and they all live in Colorado Springs or by Colorado Springs, mm-hmm. and they are in their 20s now, and their spouses, all of them, come from Colorado, so that is like, was it 14 people in adults in our family who have been born and raised and live in Colorado. And these grandchildren of ours now have 18 great-grandchildren, and they all live in the Colorado Springs area. So we truly are seven generations, and we, even to the very youngest, love Colorado.
All right, we have to wrap it up, but thank you both so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.